Well, it's a great pleasure for me, really delighted, to take part in this wonderful birthday celebration. You know, Kathleen and I first met when she came to New York University as a graduate student. I think it was 1946, but I'm not sure. And I still often have images of her as she was then, as this lovely young woman who appeared in classes and seminars and, well.
She still is.
She still is, yes. Yes, she still is. And I want to thank the organizers for the invitation to take part in this. It's really a great pleasure. I'm going to speak about a paper by Rhys Harvey and Blaine Lawson. And I apologize to those who have heard me speak on it, and I apologize even more to those who have heard Harvey or Lawson speak on it. The title of the paper is Dirichlet Duality and the Nonlinear Dirichlet Problem. And it's a paper that will appear in Communications, Pure and Applied Mathematics soon. Please feel free to interrupt, ask questions, and if I don't write large enough, please let me know. So the problem has to do with posing the Dirichlet problem for a fully nonlinear, a special class of fully nonlinear elliptic equations, and asking when can you find solutions. And their attitude is they're not looking for smooth solutions. They're just finding continuous solutions, which in the end turned out to be viscosity solutions. And, I'll talk about the paper first, a bit of background. Let me just recall what's meant by a fully nonlinear elliptic equation. So we're looking at a scalar function, so U is scalar, real function, defined in some bounded domain omega in Rn with smooth boundary. And a fully nonlinear equation is of second order is just of this kind, some nonlinear expression depending on x of u and its derivatives up to second order, and it's called elliptic, actually degenerate elliptic, if the following is true. If you look at the matrix U, it depends on a vector P, it depends on a symmetric matrix A. If you add to the symmetric matrix a non-negative matrix, then that increases the thing. And P is a non-negative symmetric matrix. So if you add to A a non-negative symmetric matrix, that increases. And that's ellipticity. It's a kind of degenerate ellipticity in terms of the derivatives of F with respect to the second derivatives. It means that this matrix is a non-negative symmetric matrix. Okay, now they are concerned with a very special class of elliptic problems, namely the F just depends on the second derivatives of U. That's the equation they look at, and they're prescribing the Dirichlet problem. U is phi on the boundary. Their phi is continuous, and they're looking for, as I say, continuous solutions, and I will explain what's meant by that. First, I would like to give a bit of background. Sorry? That will be an example. Yeah, I'll give a number of examples. Yeah. So, first, a bit of background. In the 1980s, Caffarelli and Sprook and I wrote a series of papers on nonlinear elliptic problems. Much of the work had to do with getting estimates on derivatives, and we obtained smooth solutions. And so we looked at equations. In particular, I'll just talk about one paper, just as background. In 1985, so this is Caffarelli and Sprook and myself, we looked at equations of this kind. well, we took them equal to some right-hand side. But we looked at very special Fs, which depended only on the eigenvalues of the Hessian matrix. So we looked at this kind, lambda 1, and we ordered, let's order the eigenvalues. These are the eigenvalues of the Hessian matrix. So I'll write lambda as just lambda 1 to lambda n. So we looked at functions which are eigenvalues and which are symmetric in the eigenvalues. So under permutation, symmetric. And the ellipticity was that the derivative with respect to each was positive. And we also assumed the f is concave in order to get estimates. And for example, I'll do the examples in a moment. The point of view we took, and it's that point of view that I want to describe and then show how Harvey and Lawson take a more general point of view. But the point of view we took was this. If you want to solve this equation, let's see, equals 0 or equals something, you can replace f by a function of f. You know, it still doesn't change the equation. What counts is this, that the f of lambda equals 0 defines a hypersurface in lambda space. So that's an Rn. And when you say you want a solution, what does a solution mean? So a solution means, so this defines a hypersurface sigma. Solution means that the second derivatives of u at every point x, the eigenvalues of the second derivatives of u at every point x belong to that hypersurface. That's what a solution means. And so what we did is we looked at regions in Rn of which sigma is a boundary. And let me go to that. So we're not particularly interested in the special F. Rather, we're interested in the sigma. So we looked at a region G, which we took to be an open set in Rn. Rn here is the lambda space. And the GU had this following property. We assumed the boundary was smooth. Sigma was the boundary. Smooth. It had the property for convexity that if you take any point in sigma and you add the positive cone, positive cone means lambdas with all components positive, you stay in sigma. Not sigma, sorry, G. This is G. So G plus the positive cone belongs to G. That corresponds to some kind of ellipticity. And then we also assume that the origin lay outside of G, and this thing is not particularly convex looking. Oh yeah, and we assume that G is convex. The convexity was used in our business of getting a priori estimates. Because what we did, we chose a particular function f connected with the g. So the g is what's important. And we assumed that, well, I'll just make one more thing, that the origin is outside and it's separated from g by any tangent hyperplane to sigma. The origin lies on the opposite side of g. So example. First example is Laplace equation. Summation lambda I equals 0. There the G is just this G is summation lambda I positive. That's the G. Well, here I wrote 0 and the origin doesn't lie outside, but never mind. More interesting example, Monge-Ampère equation. Determinant UIJ say, equals 1, just to take a simple case, and that's the product of the eigenvalues. Excuse me. Now, for that case, you want in this case, the G is just the positive cone. In particular, I should say, you want this thing to be elliptic, so for that it makes sense to look at convex functions. So you seek U convex in order to have ellipticity. And then it's clear that you need conditions on the omega. You cannot solve such a problem for every omega. You're automatically led to find conditions on the domain. That's part of the problem. Given a nonlinear equation, you have to find conditions on the domain in which you can solve the Dirichlet problem. And this, the natural condition is, for instance, if you want to prescribe U equals, say, a constant on the boundary of the domain omega, here's our domain omega, where U is defined. Well, this means the boundary is a level surface of a convex function, and so the boundary has to be convex. So this problem makes sense in a convex domain. And that's what we did. We solved this problem with some right-hand side also in a convex domain. Okay, let me mention one more example. The jth elementary symmetric function of the lambdas. Jth elementary symmetric function of lambdas. For instance, suppose you want to solve that sigma j lambda of the second derivatives of u, etc., equal 1. So that problem. And you prescribe U equals phi on the boundary. Again, you need some conditions on the boundary. And in our approach, the condition we used, so there are conditions on omega. And the condition we imposed, which turned out to be a natural condition, was the following, that if you look at omega, here's omega, and you take a point on the boundary, x, and you take the interior normal, and you look at the principal curvatures at that point, kappa 1 through kappa n minus 1, then our condition on omega was that there exists a number r, positive, such that this vector lies in G. In fact, we took it to be in the interior of G. Well, G was open, so. That was our condition. That's a kind of convexity condition on the domain. In case of this problem, what are the condition on the boundary, condition on omega, translates to the following, that the J minus first elementary symmetric function of the principal curvatures are positive for every x on the boundary. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about the work of Caffarelli and Spruch and myself. And now I would like to turn to Reese Harvey. Before I do Reese Harvey, let me just make an aside about the Monge-Ampère equation. This has nothing to do with the rest of the talk, but it's just a side remark. There is an old result about Monge-Ampère equation, which is the following. If you have a U in all of space, and it satisfies the determinant of the Hessian is identically 1, then U is a quadratic. And it's reasonable to ask Can you, is there a similar result if you work with, say, some other elementary symmetric function of the eigenvalues? If you look at just the sum, of course it's false. If you have a summation equals 1, that's just Laplacian. If u equals 1, of course u is not a quadratic. But it might be true with some other elementary symmetric function, and I know only one result which is connected with that, and it's a result of u1. Just a couple of years ago, and the theorem is the following. In R3, if the second elementary of symmetric function is 1, then the function is a quadratic. So if lambda 1, lambda 2, plus lambda 2, lambda 3, plus lambda 3, lambda 1 is identically 1, then u is quadratic. And the proof is a very, to my mind, a very strange proof. And that's the only result I know connected with that, the only other result. Okay, now I turn to Harvey and Wasson. They're looking at this problem. And they say, okay, that defines a hypersurface in the space of n by n symmetric matrices. So to say this is an n by n symmetric matrix, and to say that it's this matrix at every x, f of it is 0, means that it lies on a hypersurface in the space of n by n symmetric matrices for every x. So they introduce a region G like ours. So they introduce G, which is closed in the space of n by n symmetric matrices. And it has the property that this is the ellipticity, that G plus the set of non-negative matrices is contained in G. So this is the same of the set of non-negative symmetric matrices. And they want to solve that problem. What that means, so they seek solutions, say if smooth, it would mean that the at every point x, the Hessian matrix belongs to the boundary of G, which I'll again call sigma. So that's the problem. If you're looking for a function such that at every point x, its Hessian matrix belongs to the boundary of this set G, and of course you want to solve the Dirichlet problem, U equals phi on the boundary. That's the problem. And their question is, when can you do it? And what other conditions do they impose on G? For instance, we impose a convexity condition on RG. They impose no other conditions. There's no convexity. There's nothing. G is just a closed set in Rn with that property. And they say, when can you solve the Dirichlet problem? Meaning this. And they're interested in just continuous solutions. I have to explain what that means. So, in particular, they look at the homogeneous Monge-Ampère equation. That's the determinant of uij equals 0. That's just the product of the lambdas. They look at that equation. Now, we found the solution. Well, I took zero here, but one can also, we also worked with zero, but then you don't get necessarily smooth solutions, but never mind. What does it mean to look for a convex solution? It means, since all the eigenvalues are greater than or equal to zero, so u convex, which is what we looked for, just means lambda 1 is equal to zero. So you're looking for a function solution u such that if you look at the Hessian matrix, its first eigenvalue should be zero. then it's automatically convex because all the other eigenvalues are bigger. So we found a solution. They find n solutions. You can prescribe any eigenvalue to be zero. Lambda j to be zero. With j, any one from 1 to n. They get n solutions. Of course, they're not convex. But as an example of what they find are n solutions of the Monge-Ampère equation. They're not convex functions. If you take the top one, lambda n equals 0, then that means it's a concave function. Okay, so now let me come to their what they really do. There are two main concepts in their approach. I should say this paper. Yes, a word about the paper. They're just looking for continuous solutions. So I looked through the paper, first looked, and there are no a priori estimates. I'm almost ashamed to speak on this subject. There are no hard estimates at all in the paper. There's some nice, clever, tricky arguments, but there are no hard inequalities involved in the paper. So what are the two main ideas? The first of a dual problem. So they have a set G. G can look like this. Well, they can't pick it up. The positive, from any point, if you add the non-negative symmetric matrices, you lie in G. G is closed. That's the only condition on G. And they have a dual G. First idea is a dual, and it has the property that the dual of the dual is the original G. And the dual is the following. They take the interior of the set G, they take its complement, and they take its negative. That's the dual. So example, if P, what's the dual of P? P is a set of matrices which are non-negative, that means all the eigenvalues are, for instance, are greater than or equal to zero. Its dual consists of matrices A such that the highest eigenvalue is greater than or equal to zero. That's the dual. It's easy to check. That happens to be a very interesting class of functions. Functions whose highest eigenvalue of the Hessian is non-negative. It's closely related to the maximum principle. In fact, their main tool in the paper is the maximum principle. So let me make a word about maximum principle. The maximum principle says that if the function takes its maximum on the boundary, okay, it has one flaw, which I'm reluctant to say it has any flaws, since I've made a living from the maximum principle. Although if it satisfies it locally, it doesn't necessarily satisfy it globally. Local doesn't apply global. For instance, in one dimension, this function locally satisfies the maximum principle, but not globally. So, but this is attached to a different concept, which they call super-affine. Super affine functions. So U is super affine. If U plus any affine function satisfies the maximum principle. So U plus any affine function takes its maximum on the boundary. And they call that super affine. Of course, it's the same as saying U plus any linear function takes its maximum on the boundary, but they couldn't call it, I'm sorry, I'm using the wrong name. It's not super, it's sub. Excuse me. around the same time, Caffarelli and Yan Yan Li and I introduced a notion which was the analog, which we called super-affine, but I'm forgetting I'm using that name. This is sub-affine. Yeah, this is also sub-affine. Thank you. So they couldn't call it sublinear, so they called it sub-affine. Okay, and in case U is C2, this is equivalent to that. The largest eigenvalue is greater than or equal to zero, as you can easily check. So that's an interesting class of functions. Okay, the way they solve the boundary value problem is they use the Perron method. They introduce the notion of subharmonic functions relative to the problem, and they look at those functions whose boundary values are less than or equal to the given ones, and they take the supremum, and that's how they get their solution. So what do they mean by subharmonic? Subharmonic is simply relative to G. So definition. U, say C2, is G. They call it a plurisubharmonic. Harmonic. If the second derivatives of U at every point X belong to G. Just as in, if G were the half space summation lambda I positive, that would be the ordinary subharmonic functions in Rn. So this is G plurisubharmonic. I must say, I don't like the use of the pluri. They've worked a lot in complex analysis, and so they're used to this word pluri comes up, and I may sometimes slip into just subharmonic. Yeah.
What does G have from the dual?
Sorry?
You introduced the concept of the dual.
Yes, I'm going to use it.
Not in the definition of subharmonic.
No, not in the definition of subharmonic. No. No, that's the notion of subharmonic. And they're going to take the supremum of subharmonic functions whose boundary values are less than the given ones and get a solution. Now I have to tell you what they mean by a solution. So they work with upper semi-continuous functions. Is there something here? Before I talk about upper semi-continuous, just many things are based on the following remark, which is easy to check. If U is G subharmonic, so it means it's the Hessian at every point belongs to G, and if V in C, U is C2, and the V is C2, and V is the dual subharmonic, then the sum is subaffine. So that it's just a statement about matrices. If you have a matrix which lies in G, symmetric matrix, you have another matrix B which lies in G tilde, the sum of the two matrices has lambda n greater than or equal to zero. It's just a simple lemma, easy to check. But they use that in order to define G subharmonic for just general functions. So now definition. So they consider only U upper semi-continuous. And now here's a definition. We say U is G subharmonic if for every V, which is in C2, V being G tilde subharmonic, U plus V is subaffine. So that's their definition. Okay, now let me give you the definition of a solution of the equation. Solution should be, well, you'd like the function to be both subharmonic and superharmonic somehow. So here's a definition of solution. So U is a solution provided U is G subharmonic and minus U is G to the subharmonic. This is essentially saying that it's a super solution. So, and then if you have a smooth solution, these two conditions imply that the Hessian matrix lies on the boundary of G. So that's the notion of solution. Okay? But you know that you cannot solve it in all domains. So now I have to talk about the domain. For what kind of domains can you solve it? Well, let me go here. So we're looking for conditions on the domain omega. Well, they introduce a cone related to a cone in Sn cross Sn related to G. The cone they call G arrow. And it's the following. Here is G. They take a symmetric matrix B outside of G. And they look at all rays going from B, which eventually enter G. So you take the collection of all such rays, and the closure of that set forms a cone. That's the cone. But they move its vertex to be at the origin. So you take this cone, moved vertex at origin. Origin means the zero matrix. And this is independent of the choice of B, as you easily check. So that's a well-defined cone. And now they say a domain in omega is that cone convex in a certain sense, which I'm going to define. So they're going to introduce the notion of G to the convexity of the domain omega. And it's the following. Here's omega, which they take to be smooth, at least C2. They look at a local defining function, rho. Rho is a local defining function. That means it's negative, just define the neighborhood of some point on the boundary. This is the boundary of omega. It's negative inside, it's zero on the boundary, and its gradient is not zero on the boundary. So that's a local defining function. And their condition of convexity is the following, that if you look at the Hessian of rho, it lies in the, for every boundary point x, it lies in, it lies in the interior of that cone. Gee. That's their notion of convexity. They call it strong convexity, in fact, strict convexity. Okay, and now here's their theorem. Sorry?
Independent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should say. It's independent of the local defining function. In fact, they have a theorem. If omega is strictly G arrow convex, then there exists a global defining function with that property. No, it's not convexity in the classical sense. It's a different sense. It's a notion of convexity relative to the G. Yeah. Okay, and here's their theorem, their main theorem. I'll write it here. How much time do I have left?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. Yeah, maybe you can see it better there. Yeah. Yeah, why don't I say right here? Oh, here. Suppose that you know, just smooth and strictly G arrow convex and strictly for the dual set its arrow convex both, then for any continuous function phi on the boundary there exists a solution U of the problem, that's the solution defined there with given boundary values, U equals phi on the boundary, and it is unique. You may say, I wrote down n, I said they have n solutions of the Monge-Ampère equation, but I'm saying it's unique. Each solution comes with a different G. For the given G, there's a unique solution. So they use the Perron method. So the Perron method is the following. They take all functions, they consider the class of functions, well, I forgot to write down some properties, but I don't have time. They consider all G subharmonic functions in the generalized sense, V, which are less than or equal to phi on the boundary, and they take the supremum. So U of X, they define U of X as the supremum with respect to all such V of V of X. That's their solution. Now when I looked at the paper, I thought something strange, because when you use Perron method for Laplace equation, well, at some point you use the fact that you can solve the Laplace equation in a small ball. So I looked at the paper, they must use that. No such thing is in the paper. They don't use that. They prove separately that it's also, that what they get is a super harmonic. And that takes some work to prove that it's super harmonic, that it really is that this function is a solution. I should have said, when you take the supremum, what you get is not an upper semi-continuous function, but it has an upper semi-continuous regularization, and then they prove that in fact it has to be just that. So that's how they get a solution. And they're not using the fact that you can solve the problem locally in the classical sense. So then it occurred to me, if you want, of course, they have no regularity of solution at all, no regularity. For instance, they look at, here's another example. They look at G is a set of matrices with A11 greater than or equal to 0 and A22 greater than or equal to 0. The dual is a set of matrices A11 greater than or equal to 0 or A22 greater than or equal to 0. For that, they solve the following problem. U sub x1, x1 times U sub x2, x2 equals 0. It only depends really on two variables. So you cannot expect any kind of smoothness in other directions. Maybe if the phi is some smoothness. Even in the x1, x2, I don't expect smoothness for there. You know, the U equals phi on the boundary. So they have many examples. And there are applications also in complex analysis in Lagrangian geometry. But I think my time is up, and I better stop.